So anyway, this morning I did promise to give a talk on like the stages of meditation. And I'm talking about the stages of meditation just to give you a map of the territory. So there's nothing about finding out what stage am I on now. Because we want to find out what stage we're on now so we know what we have to do to get to the next stage. And the next stage, just like in life, you know, you go from grade 1 to grade 2 to grade 12 to university to master's to PhD to postdoctorate studies. You're always getting on in the life until you finally graduate in the box, in the cemetery. That's where all this getting somewhere ends up. In other words, let's forget about this whole idea of attainment and getting on in the world and getting more degrees and more qualifications and more attainments and more medals and things like that. That is not the way of meditation. The way of meditation is stillness, contentment, peacefulness. It doesn't matter what stage you're at. How content are you? How peaceful are you? How happy are you? And that's how you can measure your meditation. Not to say, I've got Nimitta to stage, but I really, 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 really want sort of jhanas. That is a very bad meditator. But someone who's really sleepy and is so happy to be sleepy, good. You've got contentment. You've got peace. You've got happiness. You'll get to the end. The person who's just this go-getter, it's just all they're going to get is a lot of suffering. So I make that point very strong. When I'm talking about stages, this is just going to give you some description of what happens. So when it does happen, you don't have to come up and say, Ajahn Brahm, is this right? What's occurring? Is this okay? Am I going crazy? What's happening? So at least you know the territory. This is what happens when you let go. When you build contentment upon contentment upon contentment, so much that you totally let go. These are the stages of what happens. And to put it in a context which emphasizes that you don't make the next stage happen, or you don't go anywhere to make the next stage happen, I developed a simile, which again, many of you have heard before, which is beautiful in that it not only describes the stages, but it also makes it very clear. If you want to get to the next stage, you've got to stay where you are and not go anywhere. And of course, it's a simile of the 1,000-petal lotus. A lotus is a symbol of Buddhism. And there's many reasons why a lotus is a symbol of Buddhism. You have the Buddha's simile of just like lotuses are born in the mud, who grow up in the mud, you know, in the dirt, in the grime. But they grow out of the mud into the water and through the water into the sunlight. It's like penetrating into the beautiful sunlight outside. That's one of the similes of the lotus. The other lotus is that water, if it drips on a lotus leaf, it just immediately just falls right off. The lotus knows how to let go of things. Yes, it can receive the raindrop, but it doesn't keep it. It flows off without wetting the lotus. That's also a very beautiful simile of letting go. A thought comes into your mind like a raindrop on the lotus petal. Yes, you receive it, but it doesn't wet you, and it just falls right off. Now that is what we're talking about, letting go. You can't stop the thoughts, but make sure they don't affect you. It's just a thought, that's all. It doesn't upset you. It doesn't excite you. That's called wetting the lotus leaf. It just falls off. So anything which happens in this retreat, whatever anyone says to you, or if they do, boil the kettle at 1 a.m. in the morning. Imagine that you are a lotus leaf, and that terrible sound has hit you. But it falls right off, leaving no residue. Now that is how we practice letting go. But the simile of the lotus, which I develop, which helps in the stages of meditation, is recognizing the way that the lotus opens up its petals in the early morning sunshine. the lotus is closed at night. And if you look at those closed lotuses, the outermost petals is always rough and dusty, because the outermost petals of the lotus have to withstand the elements, the dust, the dirt. So they are like the protective covering. But as soon as those outermost petals receive the light and the warmth of the early morning sun, they start to open up. And the outermost petal opens up to receive the layer of petals inside, which is still quite hard, but they are much more refined than the outer covering layer. And they now can receive the warmth and the light of the sun. So they open up, receiving the second layer of, revealing the second layer of petals, which are more refined. And they open up when they can receive the light and the warmth of the sun to receive the next layer of petals and the next layer of petals. The layers open up in succession. And as they open up, they get more and more beautiful, delicate and fragrant. They're more beautiful. The really nice ones are right in the middle of the lotus. Now, of course, where is the next layer of petals? The next layer of petals is right inside the layer you're looking at right now. To open up the lotus, you don't need to go to the lotus on the left or the lotus on the right. You stay where you are, and it opens up stage by stage. That's the nature of a lotus. Now, of course, in that simile, the lotus represents your mind. And the sun, its light and its warmth, represent mindfulness and compassion, the light of awareness, of mindfulness, the warmth of kindness. So, whatever you start off with, you start off with just being aware and being kind of whatever you're watching. And you know what it's like when you get up in the morning, or even after 3 or 4 days of a retreat, your lotus has hardly opened up at all. And all you can see is dirty, rough, serrated, out of age. That's no way can I get enlightened. No way can I get deep meditation. It's hopeless. In that hopeless state you're experiencing right now, inside this moment, doesn't matter how crazy, how sleepy, how absolutely stupid you think you are, the worst meditator ever since the time of the Buddha. I'm not talking about this Buddha, I'm talking about 100 Buddhas back. The very worst. If they had a Guinness Book of Records entry for the worst meditators, you think, yes, I'll be there. No! Even the very worst and hopeless meditators, the most ugliest of outermost petals, contains inside the most beautiful. I love that simile because I know that right in this moment, in your mind, right inside is the jhanas and nibbana, the whole works is right inside this moment. All you need to do is open up the coverings to see what's deeply inside this moment. So you can start with the most hopeless case. And what do you do to open up that petal to get the next layer? The sun is shining, its light and its warmth. You shine your awareness and kindness. So it doesn't matter how crazy, how tired, how restless you are, and make peace, and be kind, and be gentle, and wait. And soon that everybody, doesn't matter who you are, if you do it properly, the lotus petal will open up. And you become a little bit more peaceful and aware as you're going inside rather than outside. And that's all you do to continue on. You don't change your attitude and method of meditation as you get deeper and deeper. I know so many people have that problem. They listen to how I teach meditation, how the other monks teach. They let go and they may get to delightful breath and it's going very well. And then they start to drive their vehicle and interfere with everything. You've been doing so well, but you forget, you think, okay, now I'm at this stage, now I'll take control and make it happen. How you meditate at the very beginning is exactly the same as how you meditate in the middle. It's exactly the same as how you meditate at the end. You're just making peace, being kind, and being gentle. Like the sun doesn't change its attitude. It just keeps on throwing light and warmth onto whatever lotus petal happens to be receiving it. And just by nature, that petal opens up in its own time. So what actually happens there? You start meditating, tired, restless, hopeless. And what do you do with that? Just be aware of it. Be aware of your boredom. Aware of your restlessness. And be kind to it. And you find it opens up. It opens up. You find yourself getting into a state of peacefulness and awareness. Maybe it's in the present moment. You shine the light on time. Just being kind, being aware. And soon you find you're here. The lotus petals have opened up. You know, you've got rid of time. The time which is there on the outermost petals has opened up and you're in the middle of time. The middle of time we call the present moment, we call now. And anyone, I think, is on this retreat if has a moment where you're just right here. I saw many sun worshippers this morning out there. Enjoying the first rays of sun. Hopefully something opened up inside of you. It did. Wasn't it pleasant and warmth? And didn't you enjoy the peace of just being in the moment, enjoying the first warmth of the sun in the morning? Wasn't that nice? Recognize that. That's meditating. You're just standing there. You're not doing anything. You're not taking a photo of the sun or writing down your feelings of what the sun is like. You're just being. You come into this beautiful present moment. And as I say, a lot of burdens have gone once you're in this moment. And it happens naturally. You're just here. And it's pleasant. And there, in this present moment, you may still be thinking about a few things. But the next layer of petals which opens up, you just need to be kind and aware of this moment. And the next layer of petals which opens up is this inner commentary. It's stops. And you're standing there or sitting there peaceful. The next layer of petals, the next stage of meditation is silence. Silence lies right within the present moment. I sometimes describe it as a refinement of present moment awareness. You're so in the present moment, perfectly poised between the past and the future, that there literally is no space for a commentary. In an old simile which I put in that little green book, The Basic Method of Meditation, I said it was like a host greeting visitors at a party. You're standing at the door of the entrance receiving your guests. And as one guest comes in, you say, welcome George, welcome Veronica, welcome whoever. But that's all you can say. You can only just say welcome. Because if you get in a conversation with them, ask about their family or about their health, then you miss the guests coming right behind. You can't pause to have a conversation with any visitor. Otherwise, you miss the visitor coming right behind. And that's like the procession of events called the present moment. If you have a conversation with this moment, you miss all the moments coming right after. You miss too much. So instead, we just greet this moment, let it go, and greet the next moment, and let it go, and greet the next moment. We can't have a conversation when we're really right in present moment awareness. So going into the center of the now, it's where we find silence. We don't have to stop our mind being talking. That's a big problem, isn't it? You know, you're sitting there and you're having a sort of a conversation. You say, stop. Now, I've spoken again and again. The old joke of the four monks having the vow of silence. And one of them sneezed, and the first monk said, bless you. And the second monk, you've just broken your vow of silence. The third monk said, ha ha, so have you. And the fourth monk said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. Now the reason for that old joke is as soon as you do something, you break the silence. Like, I don't know how many of you, you know, that you know, you're keeping noble silence and somebody spoke and said, you shouldn't speak. Oops, I've broken noble silence too. That's the trouble with thinking. To stop that commentary is so hard, because if you try and stop it, you're just adding to the commentary. So what we do, I've given you many, many little tricks in that talk I gave a couple of days ago. You know, about one other trick to stop the inner conversation. If you're really going crazy and there's so many thoughts are running through your mind, go outside. Listen to the sound of the birds. Go in nature, because nature is just so delightful. You can't really have a conversation about work. There's just too many things going on out there. And if you really want to do the good practice, go outside, sit on a bench, and watch the trees grow. They do grow, you know. But you have to be very silent and patient to see it. That's what I do many times. I go out and watch the trees grow. And people say, what are you doing? I say, I'm watching the trees grow. They think I'm crazy. But they do grow, you know. It's just being patient. And actually, all it really is an excuse for doing nothing. Well, I like doing nothing. I just do too much. Every now and again, you just go out and watch a few trees grow. So, to be really silent. Because if you say something, or if you have a moment's distraction, and that's when the tree grows. You miss it. Oh, damn. So it's a little trick to try and keep the mind quiet. Go and listen to the birds, or listen to the sound of the wind, or whatever else. Because that actually calms you down. And so you don't get into long conversations. But really all you're doing is opening up another layer of petals. Going into the present moment, and the silence, right in the center of the present moment. And oh my God, it's really nice. Yeah, so many times, I don't know about you losing your sleep, I will never forget a retreat I did in Penang over Christmas a couple of years ago. It was over Christmas because they have holidays there. And that Christmas, I was about second or third story, and it was overlooking a street on the other side of the road. They decided to have a Christmas party, which you don't mind, but it was a karaoke party. And now that's, I think, the first time I've really heard karaoke. And I hope it's the last time I hear karaoke. And it was actually crazy, because this was Christmas. I think there were a bunch of Christians, and so they were getting drunk. And now, by the time you've had enough alcohol, everybody thinks they're Frank Sinatra. Everybody thinks they can sing as good as Madonna. I don't know who else sings these days. And so this lady was hogging the microphone. She was singing really loud, out of tune, and it was just terrible to hear. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. That was torture. You couldn't go to sleep and you're trying to meditate and teach people to meditate early in the mornings, and it was gross. And so from that time on I realized that the very lowest of the hells, you know, they've got those places where you've got those tubs and people prick you with sort of, you've seen, you know, with spears and stuff, you see them on the temple walls. Worse than that, for the very, very worst offenders, you go to the karaoke hell. Ah, I hope I never do bad karma for that. But you know, when it stopped, oh, that was bliss. It stopped at last. And I was so happy. It was actually peaceful. And the peace just was so resonant with happiness. I thought, oh, this is so nice. And that's just like the karaoke going on between your ears. It is out of tune, and it is rubbish. You don't think like Einstein, although sometimes your arrogance says you can. You're drunk with pride. So that stuff just goes in our heads. We go right into the center of it, until it opens up in the present moment, in the center of now, and you can't hear any more commentary. The karaoke is finished. Oh, what bliss. So, the deeper you go in meditation, the more beautiful are the petals and the more fragrant. It's right in this crazy mind, right in the center is now, and the center of now is silence. And you don't do anything, you stay with the silence. And as the silence starts to finish, your body disappears. You're going right into the center of your body. So the legs disappear, the hands disappear, the heads disappear. It's like another karaoke, a physical karaoke has disappeared. My body. The body petals have opened up and now they're gone. And in the middle you usually see your breath. The reason why you see your breath, as I mentioned before, because that's the only thing which is moving. Is there anything doing anything? You know, you're not thinking. You're not moving, you're not doing anything. So all you're doing is breathing. It's the only thing which is making any disturbance. So quite naturally, in the middle of that body, you will find your breath, your breathing. And you don't need to locate it on the body. In fact, you can't locate it in the body. The body's disappeared. All you've got left is a feeling of the breath. And I mentioned, I very, very rarely, if ever, focus on my breath when I meditate. I just do this beautiful letting go practice, making peace, being kind, being gentle. And my lotus petal, they open, it just appears. You don't seek the breath just manifests, it's just there. And when that breath manifests, that breath is always very soft and gentle. If you try and find your breath and say, right, I'm going to watch the breath at the tip of my nose, it's always rough and disturbing. If you want to do the Rolls-Royce meditation method, this is it. You just don't do anything. They come with their own time. You can't say when the breath is going to manifest. You have to be very patient. That is so important in this method of meditation. So why I did mention in passing the two types of patience, or rather the two types of waiting. Because sometimes we don't really know what patience is and we mistake the second type for the first type. But the type which is the wrong type of patience is waiting for something to happen. I call that waiting in the future. And much of our waiting is that. You're waiting for someone to call. You're waiting for the bell to go. You're waiting for lunch. You're waiting for Godot, as in Beckett's famous play. And of course, for those of you who know Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, Godot never comes. You may be waiting for nimittas, waiting for jhanas, it will never come. Because you're waiting in the wrong place. You're waiting in the future. Waiting for something to happen. That is the wrong type of waiting. Please recognize that. That's a very fine point of insight. The other type of waiting is waiting in the moment. Or sometimes I just call it waiting on the moment. Just like a waiter at a restaurant. If they're going to get a tip, they've got to be aware, not of the future, but of the present moment, of their customers on the table. Be aware that when they finish the first course, so they can take the plates away and give them the next course. They can be aware when their glasses need filling. They're not waiting in the future. They're waiting on their customer in this moment. Your customer, your client, is whatever is happening now. You wait on that. And what do I mean by waiting on it? You're being aware and being kind. That's all. I call that waiting on the moment rather than waiting in the future. Waiting in the future is another word for expectation. And sometimes we just don't see it. We wonder why it is our meditation doesn't work. Look, I've been meditating, I've been following all your instructions, and I still haven't got nimitta. You just told me you've been waiting in the future, you've been waiting and wanting something to happen. That is wrong, you'll never get anywhere that way. Wait in the moment, on the moment. Your client is what's happening now. Your job is to be kind to that client, to be aware of it. That's all. Your son is being aware and giving warmth to this moment. And if you wait on the moment, all these things happen. It just opens up in its own time. And 9 days is plenty of time. The trouble is, you waste a lot of time. That's the problem. So, opening up that lotus. And you get this beautiful breath. The breath is there, that's all. You don't do anything. Now, those of you who've heard about these stages of meditation, or read Anapanasati Sutta, then you think, right, I'm on this stage. What's the next stage? How many people on a journey? We keep on thinking, when are we going to get there? How many more kilometers does go? You know, you watch the signs, Perth 60 kilometers, Perth 40 kilometers, Perth 20 kilometers. How long is there to go? Or you're going on these aircraft and look at that seat monitor on the back, you know, with the flight path. How long to go to get to Singapore? 1 hour, half an hour, 15 minutes, 2 minutes. And then you find the plane is delayed, so you've got to go around, so it's another half an hour before you get in. Whatever it is, why are we always waiting for something to happen? Why always are we counting the minutes until some event is going to happen? Why is it that we're waiting for lunch? Who knows? There may not be any lunch today. It actually happened here once. The people got lost. They're supposed to be being in Dana, and they never found the place. That might happen again today. The lunch is uncertain. Don't count on it. So, that way you're wasting your time on things which don't even happen. You're wasting all these amazing moments to get deeper into yourself and closer to enlightenment. So you just wait with the breath. You don't even expect the next stage, which I call the delightful breath, to happen. All that really occurs is when you shine your compassion and your awareness on this breath, it gets softer and more peaceful until it becomes delightful. That delightful, you're going deep into the lotus, that's why it's more happy, more fragrant, more beautiful. That's one of the other reasons I like the lotus simile. The deeper you go, the more delicious it becomes. That's a sign you're going in the right direction. Increased happiness, profundity, delight. And that's a wonderful thing to know about meditation. If you really get into it, it's no longer sort of a torture. It's not like going to the dentist. It's not like some religious penance which you have to do. You know, I know that it was Easter recently, and some crazy people in the world, they actually nailed themselves to the cross. They crucify themselves because they think they're going to get somewhere that way. They're making a penance, trying to get rid of their sins by doing what Jesus was supposed to have done. I can't sort of imagine the craziness of human beings. But somehow people think that in religion you have to suffer. When I went to church as a kid, this was in London, it was freezing cold, and there was no cushions on the pews. There was stone everywhere. It all looked as if it was some sort of underground torture cell of the military. There was no comforts there. You know, not even a toilet there to go to. It was all telling me that this is suffer. Jesus suffered, so you guys have to suffer. And that was before the priest started talking. He never told any jokes. I mean, what's going on here? Is this religion? Is this supposed to be suffering? And that's not the sort of thing which I wanted. You know, I wanted the spirituality to be delightful, to be beautiful, to be profound, inspiring. I want to go out of a church or a synagogue or a temple. I want to go out a better person. Inspired, happy, compassionate. What are these guys doing? Haranguing you like that? You're a sinner. You didn't get up early in the morning. You just did this. You didn't worship enough. It's all just punishment and fear. That was totally against what I thought spirituality, religion should be. But see, all Buddhists think that way with meditation. They think, let's punish ourselves. Or you, Ajahn Brahm's retreats, it's just too soft. Sitting on chairs, no way in the next retreat. Everybody on the floor. No cushions, or maybe just one cushion, but no more. Just one cushion. And you will get up at 4 o'clock. Not 5 past. And none of this teas whenever you want. We just have water, cold water, that's all. And all this nice food, no. Just, we put it all in one bowl, just like the monks. We'll stir it all up. Whatever we get today. Even better, let's have a trough, like the pigs do. Put it all in there. Curries, rice, sweets, juices, all, and stir it all up. You can take as much as you want. It's just like, it's going to mix up anyway inside your stomach. Let's save time and mix it up right now before it goes into your mouth. We're not going to indulge in sensory pleasures. You know, some monks have done that. I don't mind telling these stories. He's still a good friend. Ajahn Suchito in Chittas Monastery. When he was young, he was just a really tough guy. And that's what he would do. You know, he would just get the food in the morning. This was during the rains retreat for 3 months. He did this. In Chittas Monastery, all the food in one pot. Doesn't matter what anybody bought that day. It could be ice cream. It could be spaghetti. All in one pot, and he stirred it all up. And then every monk, visitors as well, you could take as much as you want in your bowl, but it was stirred up beforehand. I think after a couple of weeks it was a riot. He stopped it. He did that for a couple of weeks. It's so crazy. It's interesting, isn't it? Just what we do. No, that is actually not the way of religion, especially not the way of Buddhism, which is a very soft and beautiful and happy path. Because we get the idea, if we force ourselves, effort, we're going to get stronger, resist the pain, you know, just push through, and then we're going to win. And then that's military, isn't it? Have you ever known how military offences using force, they never create any peace or stability, they just create more instability in the world? But still we think, oh, if we use a bit more force, if we have a few more tanks, a few more smart missiles, and then we're going to win. You never do, do you? Oh, you might conquer, but you never win. There's always a lot of resentment happens afterwards. And just the conflicts just simmer under the surface until the next time. So that way of force and aggression, please don't use that in your meditation. That's not the Buddhist way. So instead we're just with this breath, and it gets more delightful and more beautiful. And this is a path of delight, of happiness. When I realized that, I realized how fortunate I was to have found a path like this. A path of happiness upon happiness upon happiness. Deeper and deeper and deeper. Peace. And you never realize how far it's going to take you. It takes you incredible places. And that's where it's going to take you. So you just watch this ordinary breath. And sometimes there's no happiness there at all. It's just breath going in. But stay there. Wait in the moment. With kindness, with awareness. It's that kindness is the most important thing to create the happiness. Just be kind to this silly old breath. And little by little, it starts to brighten up. And you find yourself watching this delightful breath, just breathing in, breathing out, as happy as Larry. I don't know where they got that. I never actually met Larry. But they say as happy as Larry. I think he must be a meditator. Was Larry a Buddhist monk? I reckon that actually comes from the word for an enlightened one, Arahat. But they couldn't really say Arahat. So from Arahat we got Ari and Ari Larry. So as happy as Larry, I think that's, you know, it's just a corruption, as happy as an Arahat. I don't know, that's my idea. If anyone can actually find a better idea for the meaning of happy as Larry, let me know. But that's an Australian slang saying, he's as happy as Larry. So anyway, you're happy, just sitting there watching your breath, having a great time. And actually you're quite surprised, it's one of the best times of your life. You say, my goodness, I'm not going to a movie, I'm not going to the Great Wall of China or watching the Himalaya mountains at sunset. I'm just doing something as simple as just watching my breath, and it's one of the happiest times of my life. Doesn't that give you some insight into the meaning of happiness? People spend so much money and so much time seeking happiness in places where it's not real. It's only momentary. And it hasn't got the, so it's like plastic happiness. And then you just let go and watch your breath. And you get the happiest experience of your life. And it's real. It's not sort of confected happiness. And there it's so simple. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to pay anything. It's just there. You're going into your lotus and realizing that the happiness lies deep within. There are all the happiness, truth, beauty, delight you could ever want and much more. Lies right in the middle of this moment. Of you, right now, right here. You don't have to change anything. You just need to go in instead of going outwards. So there you are in this beautiful breath. And you never even think to go on to the next stage, because going on to the next stage is going out of that happiness and losing everything. You never go on to anything. You never go out to get to anything better. The next stage is right within, the stage you're in now. So there you're just with this delightful breath. And the delightful breath gets so smooth and so delightful, you can hardly tell the difference between an in-breath and an out-breath. In fact, you don't tell the difference. It's just delightful, that's all. Delightful breathing. Until the delightful breathing, you can't notice the breath anymore. There's a switch happens. From watching the breath through the physical sense of touch to watching the breath through the sixth sense of mind. You know the breath, you don't feel the breath. And that's actually a profound insight as well. Because sometimes when that first happened to me, you went deeper in. And I thought, I've lost my breath. I can't feel it anymore. But I was still aware. I was wondering what the heck I was aware of. After a long time I realized I was aware of the breath. But I was aware of the breath through the sense of knowing, not feeling. It was a different sensation. I hadn't lost the breath. It's only I didn't feel it anymore. I knew it through the mind, not through the sense of touch. And of course it was far more refined and far more delightful. Really what happened was the experience of the breath disappearing. The breath as I knew it, through touch, had gone. And what was left was still the breath, but knowing. It was pure mind. And that's where this beautiful light comes up. The breath has opened up to the delightful breath inside. And the delightful breath, you don't make it happen. Many people keep asking me, how do I get nimittas? When I get the nimittas, what do I do with the nimittas? Look, those are stupid questions. When these things happen, you stay where you are, waiting in the moment, just being kind, making peace. It's all you ever do, which is actually doing nothing. Somebody asked me that the other day in interviews. Oh no, it's actually a question. Isn't making peace, being kind, being gentle, isn't that doing something? It's actually not doing something, it's stopping doing. Making peace is not doing anything. Being kind is allowing things to be. Being gentle is not doing anything. Unfortunately, if I say don't do anything, people don't understand. So these are the words which describe how you do nothing. It's making peace. Being here, being still. So it's not what you do, it's what happens when you stop doing. When you stop doing, you find you're making peace. When you stop fighting, you find you're being gentle. When you stop being negative to where you are and wanting to be somewhere else, you find you're being kind. So it's a sign of you've let go of doing when you're kind and when you're peaceful. So this is all we do, and the lotus opens up. And from the beautiful, delightful breath, we get to this stage. The breath has disappeared. And a beautiful light appears in the mind. It's called the nimitta. That particular stage is incredibly delightful if you follow the instructions and doing the right way. You know that sometimes people get so impatient, they take hold of the lotus with their fingers and they start peeling it. You know, they go the fast way. Yeah, and you may even get to a nimitta, but it's not nice. You know, you forced it. And it hasn't got that same fragrance and beauty and softness. If you follow the path, when the nimitta arises, it's just so wonderful and delightful. And of course, what made a lot of... took me a long time to do this. What the heck is this nimitta? It was as if you were looking in a mirror at your own face. And you see the image of your face. This was the mind looking at itself. This was an image of your mind. And it was fascinating when that insight came up. That this nimitta, exactly what it was. It was your mind, your jitta. And you were actually seeing it for the first time. And because of that, if your jitta, if your nimitta is beautiful, well done, that means you're a beautiful person. And I'm not just saying that. There are some people I've known for a long time. These are the members of our Buddhist society over in Perth or overseas who are always helpful. They're always there doing things in the background. They never complain, they never criticize, always ready to serve. These are those pure-hearted people, which I'm sure you know some of them. You see someone and say, they're just a good person. They never criticize, they never complain, they're always there cleaning up when everyone else has gone home. Just some really good people. And I know those people. And I know what's going to happen when they see the nimitta for the first time. It's beautiful. Incredibly lovely. All of their good deeds and their kindness, and you can't fake it, is right there, and it's this beautiful, beautiful nimitta. That's their jitta. Other people, I never forget this one young man in Kuala Lumpur, who when he first got his nimitta the first time, he came to see me very disturbed. Because his nimitta, yeah, it was there, but it was dirty and stained. It was just like an old rag which hadn't been washed for years. And I said, what have you been doing? And he was very embarrassed. He'd been messing around, not keeping precepts, being selfish and stuff like that. So when he saw himself for the first time, there's no more denial. I told him, you better clean up your act and keep these precepts, okay? Because, you know, he saw himself. He saw what he'd been doing. And that's a great example. When your nimitta comes up the first time, there's no more sort of, you know, the arrogance and thinking what you are and what you're not. You'll see yourself there by the brilliance and the beauty of that jitta which you see. If you've been breaking any precepts or just being cruel, being selfish, lying or whatever, that won't look nice. Your jitta has been stained. That's why they sometimes call it defilement. And this is actually surprising. I never expected this. This is actually what you see. That's actually a wonderful thing to know, that, you know, there's an honesty in this meditation, a truth. It's an insight. The insight, you see yourself who you are. But don't worry, most of you get nice nimittas. That was actually quite a rarity. I got someone who was a Buddhist, had such a lousy nimitta. Most of you are beautiful, because you do good things. Straight away, any of you who think that you're bad or evil or terrible or whatever, that will give you a lot of encouragement that you're not as bad as you thought. That nimitta is quite nice. Well done. So when that nimitta comes up, if it really is beautiful, it's so easy to stay with. You're enjoying it. But then if it is a little bit dirty, there is these tricks. And the tricks of the trade is that don't look at the bad part, look at the beautiful part. Those of you who had fault-finding minds, who always see the spot on the dinner plate, who always see the one brick which is crooked, which always sees the one piece of timber on this floor which wasn't laid straight. Now there's one corner which is out. The person who laid this showed it to me. Hopefully you haven't seen it. If you had, you've got fault-finding mind. And with a mind like that, when you get these nimittas, you will always go to the defects. Straight away, you'll go to the part which isn't beautiful. You'll go to the part which is smeared and grey. That is a problem. There are those others who've got a positive mind. They're just so grateful to be here. I'm so lucky to be in a room to my own. You can boil as many kettles and slam as many doors as you like. This is so much bliss to that retreat I did in KL, where I had to share a room with so many people. Oh, thank you so much. You've got such a beautiful, positive lack of fault finding. But when the nimitta comes up, you may have a lot of grey parts, but you go straight to the beautiful part. How does it matter, those grey parts? I'm so happy to have a nimitta. And there's one tiny little spot there which is beautiful. Oh, wonderful. And you go straight there. And you know what you go to actually starts to expand. And so if you look at the beautiful part of those nimittas, that beautiful part expands and expands. And you just have a beautiful nimitta now. So you've got a choice. You go to the dull part or you go to the beautiful part. And you can't do that through will. It becomes your inclination. And if you trained in these beautiful attitudes of gratitude, respect, forgiveness, kindness, the things which are the opposite of fault-finding, then that's where you'll incline to the beautiful part. It is why that many of these attitudes we teach, even in Nodamo, it's not just about learning to live daily life with less problems. This is very profound, deep stuff which will affect your path to enlightenment. You'll start to see the beauty in the nimitta. And because your mindfulness and kindness is just shining on that nimitta, it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. I love saying this because it excites me, because it's just my beautiful memories. Sometimes that nimitta just gets so brilliant and so happy. You know, this is many times you feel you're going to explode, that no human being can take so much pleasure and bliss. That's what it feels like sometimes. But I know from experience, you can take even more bliss than that. And soon it comes. Ahosu kam, big time. I'm saying this because this is what happens, and this shows what meditation does. So you go inside that nimitta, the nimitta petals open up, and you go right inside. And inside the nimitta petals, that's what the Buddha described as the first jhana. Blissed out. The sort of stage which I'm pretty sure that some medieval monks got into and described it as union with God and became saints afterwards. If you get into that state of the first jhana, Daniya, they would call you Saint Daniya. It would be Saint Bianca. And they would have a school named after her. And your kids would go to St. Daniel's school. Unfortunately, sort of, you know, we know better than that. So that's just the first jhana. But that gives you an idea of how profound and how lofty and how incredible these things are. These are huge states of mind. So when someone comes along and they say, yeah, I got first jhana today. And they're not totally blissed out, spinning out, as if they had just seen a supernatural being. I know that that's not first jhana. If you get into these jhanas, that's going to really spin you out big time. You're going to be changed. Your whole world is going to be turned into a different direction. Just as if you did see God this afternoon. Wow! And this is what you experience. And it's brilliant. I got into a lot of trouble. I think I still am in a lot of trouble for teaching these jhanas. Because some of the monks would tell you, no, teach them to monks, but never ever teach them to lay people. And I thought, why not? To me that doesn't feel fair. And it's also, you start teaching and some of you guys actually do it. Brilliant, well done. And so I'm actually very happy that I started teaching jhanas. I don't care what people say. But these are brilliant and very high states of mind. What do you do next? Because there's many more jhanas to come. I say that you get so much bliss, you can't imagine, it's impossible there can be anything more. And then more things happen. You're in this beautiful, incredibly beautiful lotus petal core first jhana. It opens up. And you're inside the middle of it, the second jhana. And that opens up into the third. You just stay and it just does it by itself. You can't do anything. You don't do anything. Waiting in the moment, just making peace, being kind. It's your habit now. And all these stages open up. Third jhana into fourth. And the fourth into these immaterial realms. These incredibly powerful states. This is actually where your mind starts to vanish. It's as if, like those petals of the lotus, get more and more thin. They're gossamer thin, until they're hardly petals at all. But incredibly beautiful, until the last one opens up. And inside, of course, the only thing you can have in the end of the lotus opening up, they're already getting so thin, so ethereal, as if they're not there. In fact, the last layer of petals is called neither perception or non-perception. And of course, that just confuses the hell out of people. What on earth do you mean? But if you go to those places, when you come out afterwards, you will realize just what an incredible teacher the Buddha was. Not only will you recognize from your own experience that Buddha knew what he was talking about, that he'd gone there, but also and understand his incredible wisdom that he could actually find a name for those states. States which just defy descriptions, because they're so different than the world outside, the world in which you know. That language is just inadequate. But the Buddha found some words. Now to me that was one of his great attributes. Not only had experience, but he could teach and describe accurately, which was amazing. So you'd understand those words, neither perception or non-perception, is the best and only way you could describe that state. You have to be there to know it. But at least you can tell by those words that things are vanishing fast. And everything vanishes. Inside the middle of the lotus, what Ajahn Chah said to me, there's nothing. My me and I. Emptiness gone. Poof, nibbana. So some people say, is that what we're doing here? Just to disappear and vanish? You mean we put all this effort into meditating and getting into enlightenment and there's nothing left when we get there? Can't we just enjoy a little bit, please? But I think you should get the point, the whole teaching of meditation, of letting go, of seeing things disappear. Where do you think this could end? Except in everything disappearing, with nothing being left. The way of meditation, the path, should be telling you where this is heading and what the goal is. The goal of vanishing. And I'm talking about everything vanishing. Oh, what bliss. Ahosukam. That's a simile of the thousand petal lotus. Any questions? Great. Get out of here. Vanish. Disappear. Bye-bye, Angie. Are you waving goodbye? No, she had a question. Okay, question. craving for peace is a source of suffering. No, it's actually recognizing the irritations of noise and body. If you crave peace, then of course you suffer more. That's what Ajahn Chah described as disturbing the sound. But whether you crave peace, I was actually not craving peace, I was craving sleep. I just wanted to, I was so tired. So it's bodily aches and pains. But it was the point of that simile is when the noise ended. Oh, what peace. When the thoughts inside your head stop. Wasn't that nice? You feel so much freedom. I don't have to think. I don't have to work things out. The goal of philosophy, finding a verbal solution to the meaning of life, is finished. Silence. That's where truth lives. Somebody once said that when you think, you're thinking about things. Just like a satellite goes round and round and round and round but never comes home. Always going around the earth but never meeting the earth. They said that's what thoughts do. They go around the subject. They never meet it. They never penetrate it. I thought it was a wonderful analogy. What do you think about that, Angie? Trick question. You say nothing. And I say, well done. Go on. Well, a lot of times, if you say, when you try to make peace and live a simple life, all these things keep popping up. Yeah, they do. But you know you have a lot of time which you waste. When you don't really have to do things. You don't really have to watch that movie. You really don't need to get on that email. You don't really need to find out what's happening in the weather or on the stock market. We do waste so much time. And a lot of times, not all the time, a lot of times we seek out the irritating people. We're just crazy. Sometimes we get so bored with peace, we don't value it. We go and disturb it. We want to find out something to do. And psychologists know that sometimes we seek out abusive partners. Sometimes we seek out sort of disturbing situations. I could never figure out why people go to these movies which scare the shit out of them. It's scary going to these. I know people said The Aliens was the most scary movie. I don't know. Is that the most? What's the most scary movie you've ever been to? But whatever, it was a really scary movie. And you know you're going to sort of get terrified. Why do people queue up outside wanting to go? They have these things apparently called tearjerkers. These movies which are so sad, you've got to take tissues with you. You know it's going to be, oh, terrible. Something's going to happen. The boy and girl are almost going to get there. They're almost going to have happiness. In the last moment, something gets in the way. Oh, it's so sad. They almost made it. You know that's going to happen. You know you're going to suffer. Why do you go there and listen to it? Because people want stimulation. And they're just afraid of peace. That's the trouble. It's a fear of peace. And the reason should be quite clear. Because if you follow this path, and I've been quite honest with you, you're going to disappear. And that's the most terrifying thing a person can do. For their self to vanish. The one thing behind all the other attachments, me. To let that one go, that is scary. But fortunately, you do it because it's so much fun. The delight, the pleasure, the sheer bliss of you disappearing is what overcomes the fear. All those irritating people and experiences, Angie, most of them you bring on. I've known you for a long time and I respect you. But it's true. All those irritating experiences I have, and Ajahn Brahmali told me a couple of nights ago, you know, you brought that on, you know that, don't you? Because he started talking to me about, you know, when we held the global conference here, you know, I gave it the title, Confronting Controversies. And he said, you like controversies, don't you? I said, no, I like peace. He said, no, come on, be honest, okay. It's great having monks who can actually criticize you and point out things which you know but you don't dare to admit. So be careful. So you bring up these things by yourself. Okay, that gives you something to contemplate. Okay, so thank you for those questions and comments. And now, what are you supposed to do? Nothing. Just shine your peace and your compassion on your lotus and see what happens. See how far you can open up. Wait in the moment. Okay, very good.